BBC Sounds. Music, radio, podcasts.
Just a word of warning. This podcast includes strong language, use of racist terms, and descriptions of violence. Be warned.
It was the most amazing sight you would ever come across. All hell broke loose.
It's been a day of violence at Brixton in South London.
A sea of black faces that numbered Brixton like sand. All that was going through my mind was, this is the time we're going to kill some police.
In 1981, a huge riot broke out in London.
Everybody was on the street in their little crews, but they were all together now, against the police, out on the streets of Brixton. And the weather was good. It was amazing.
It was all out war between the people and the police.
Hundreds of police, crouched behind their riot shields, are advancing cautiously through a maze of back streets, which are barricaded with dozens of overturned, blazing cars. The police are being pelted with petrol bombs, bricks and bottles. In return, they drum their truncheons on their riot shields.
I could see it in people's eyes, the anger. They actually wanted to kill me because of the uniform I wore, what I represented, a symbol of oppression, repression, violence. They wanted to kill me, and it was utterly terrifying.
This podcast is the story of how a community reached tipping point and all flipped at the same time.
We didn't sit down and say, let's burn Brixton down today. It wasn't like that.
What happened back then was the start of a conversation was still being had today.
I am, along with the rest of the black community from the 70s and 80s, we are the original Black Lives Matter. Without us, there would be no Black Lives Matter in this country, because we are the catalyst.
From BBC Sounds and BBC Radio 5 Live, this is Brixton, Flames on the Frontline. Episode 1, The Fuse is Lit. My name is Big Nasty, and I'm a Brixton native. It was where I was born. And growing up, all the elders used to talk about the uprising. We knew it was a big deal and a turning point, but we didn't really know what had gone down, what really caused it. In this podcast, we're going to meet the people involved to find out what happened to them in the years before the riots, to set the course for that confrontation. To find out, we're going back to the 70s.
My name is Christopher Aisha, and I was involved in the original Brixton uprisings back in 1981. We don't call them riots, we call them uprisings.
My name is Shelton Thomas, and during the 1981 uprisings, I was one of the major players, along with Christopher, who was my right-hand man.
We're going to take you back to when Christopher was 13 and Sheldon was 12. They're tight and they've spent their childhoods together. They come as a pair. Now, they're about to discover Brixton when Christopher moves into the area. Having spent their whole lives in mainly white neighbourhoods, this is going to be a whole new adventure.
The way people walked down the road was different. So that kind of gave us a boost. It gave me a boost of energy. A boost of something that I'd never seen before.
When you walked into Brixton, you got the feeling you was back home, you was in the Caribbean. You got the feeling you was in some part of the Caribbean. The food we bought was very similar to each other. It doesn't matter which part of the Caribbean island you came from. So we'd buy the yam, the green banana, plantain. So everything you wanted that you would eat in the Caribbean, we could buy here in Brixton.
They ain't seen nothing like this. They feel mad at home, like they belong here. But their energy is pushing them to one street in particular.
Railton Road, we used to call it the front line. It was, if you like, the backbone of Brixton's black cultural community.
They didn't know it yet, but Railton Road, the front line, would be the center of the uprising.
It was like the stronghold where the essence of reggae music flowed through.
Dreadlocks get living at tenement, yeah. Dreadlocks get living at tenement, yeah.
You could go down Railton Road and there'd be clubs, there'd be snooker halls, there'd be people selling weed on the road. There was no police, or it didn't seem like there was any police. Railton Road was unlike any other road that I'd ever known in my life, and it made me feel safe just being down there. You know, we used to have this thing that we said, if you ever got into any trouble, just run down Railton Road and you'd find some help, or you'd be safe, you know, some backup or whatever. Railton Road was, it was home. Too much informers
and too much beers. Tony Seeley grew up at the same time as Christopher and Sheldon. But unlike them, he was from Brixton. He knew all about Railton Road.
The frontline part of Brixton, it was almost like a danger paradise because you had lots of shops where people would be wearing wonderful clothes, Italian-style clothes, because of that was the style for some of those older boys who wanted to look glamorous. You had music on pretty much every corner, whether that was out of someone's car or just, you know, someone's house playing music. And people sort of up and down the street who knew each other. And it was certainly a place of where family resided and community was at its sort of utmost, really.
When I was about 5 years old, we moved to the Brixton area. We lived on Shakespeare Road opposite the railways.
10 years earlier than the Brixton boys, Christopher, Sheldon and Tony, a white kid, Paul, was growing up there.
It was a slum area and families lived in a room or two. It was like Victorian buildings, like really tall buildings, black from the soot from chimneys. And some actually still had gas lighting. The area was sort of littered by bomb sites, you know, from World War II. I guess everyone knows the West Indians were invited over to help rebuild Britain after the war. And their sons and daughters were also in my school.
When the Windrush docked in Tilbury in Essex, many people made their way to the Labour Exchange for jobs and turned up in Brixton. It was a good place to set up home, and the Caribbean community sprung up.
Yeah, I had this friend, Errol. He was in my class, and after school, I'd go and hang out at his parents' place, and I'd have, like, rice and peas for the first time, and they even had, like, a picture of the Queen on the wall, which was a surprise, because we probably had, like, Karl Marx on our wall, because I think my parents were sort of communists, obviously, having Karl Marx on the wall. But, yeah, he'd come over and he'd have shepherd's pie or something, so it's, like, quite a contrast. I do remember, it's like him playing a few records on his parents' record player, and it was like sort of music that sort of jumped up and down, a bouncy sort of music, probably like Prince Buster or something at that period, which was sort of popular then. But walking home, what I distinctly remember on Sambalayton Road, amongst the bomb sites and slums, there's always this group of characters that used to hang out on the corner, and they had like sort of these hats and sort of fancy suits, and I you know, it's just the coloured suits that people wore. Everybody else seemed to be, the general population seemed to be just dressed in grey. And actually, one thing I do remember is at the end of the street, which in those days meant nothing to me, there was some sort of painted symbol on the wall that said "Keep Britain White," but for me, I knew no different, and to me, Sambalayton Road was the centre of the world, and I suppose in some ways, in my naive way, I assumed that the rest of the world was like this.
You feeling the place yet? It's vibrant, exciting, but there's also a menace, and it ain't just some racist graffiti on the walls. A decade later, when the Brixton boys were on the streets, they felt the threat came from the police on the beat. In this podcast, we're going back in time with dramatic recreations of events which changed our characters' lives. Actors take us right back to the moments that put Sheldon, Christopher and Tony on a path that led them directly into the riots. Let's join a young Tony right there in the heart of Brixton, back in the day, in the 70s.
One of my favourite places along Atlantic Road on the front line was this clothes shop called Temples. I liked it so much because it sold some seriously nice and well-made expensive Italian suits with matching shoes and shirts. I was broke most of the time. And I remember the number of times I would be looking into the window of Temples and I'll be drawling at those suits, those shirts, those shoes, imagining myself in them. I remember thinking, right, that's it. I can't take it anymore. The next grant money that I'll get is going to go on those crisp-looking pair of Farrah trousers that are staring back at me through the window. And that jumper. And that shirt. You had to be quick back as well, because fashion was changing almost every week. There was always something new in the window at Temples. And I always had to stop and look. And it wasn't just me. Brers my age, older brers, younger brers. We all did it. It was like a rite of passage looking into Temple's shop window. I will never forget the time when I was just looking through the Temple's window one day, when I heard some other brer shout out, "Beast come!" That was it. That was all he said. And before I could even have the chance to look around properly, to see who it was that was saying that, I see about three or four white officers coming right up to me, asking me, "What are you doing?" "What am I doing?" And I said to them, "Nothing. I'm just looking in the shop window." That is when the shoving began. Them at me, me at them. All while they kept asking, "What are you doing? What drugs do you have on you? What drugs do I have on me?" The last shove one of them gave me is when it really started to kick off. He went from asking what I was doing to empty your pockets, whilst his mate was going through my pockets without my permission. And I was going, "Hey, just get off me, eh? Leave me alone, I've got nothing. I haven't done anything." And then one of the officers grabbed my arm and was bending it. He was bending it so hard. The pain was reaching all over my body. I was out of it. Which I suppose was the point, because that allowed one of the other officers to carry on searching me. And I remember him kicking my feet to open my legs and pushing me up onto the glass window. And I just remember feeling so humiliated at that time. And I look up and I see a whole line of other brers. All of them. All of us having our faces pushed up against the glass window of Temples. We all had the same thought. The exact same fear. Is it our turn? Are we getting beat up here? Or getting thrown into the back of their vans? Anyone who knows didn't want to get thrown into one of them. Mostly because you will not be the same person when you come out. I heard the stories. We all did. I don't mind telling you. I was scared. Scared as well as disgusted. Disgusted because there was not a trace of dignity about who I am, or manners, or respect. Not even when they let us go. Told us to be on our way. Stay out of trouble. That was it. It was so casual for them. Roughing up some black boys was natural for them. It was brushing their teeth that morning. Somehow I never thought it would happen to me. And for it to happen to me just really made me now much more scared of the police. Because they were so brutal with the policing, you know? And the language that they used on as we were being searched. The usual wogs this, black that. On and on. To treat me like I'm nobody. To treat anyone like that. It's bound to have a lasting effect because, you know, walking away from that, I remember feeling quite shook and shaken up. After that, I decided, I don't want to talk to the police, ever. I don't want to have any kind of relationship with them. They targeted and brutalized an entire community. That is unforgivable.
I've been pulled by the police myself and it ain't good. From my experience, I can tell you once you feel like a target, your reality shifts. It does something to you. Any respect for the police is gone. For Christopher Aisha, this moment came when he was running for the bus.
And I didn't realise as I was running for the bus, the police were actually chasing me in the road. We had open back route masters in those days and you could run down the road and jump on. Coming home from school, running for this bus. I jumped to catch the bus. But instead of going forwards, I went backwards because there was a policeman chasing me and he grabbed me as I jumped and pulled me back. down into the floor. And these police were standing over me. I was in the road, on the floor. All the people at the bus stop were all looking like, you know, he's just caught some robber or something. I was just coming from school. So this was how it was. And it just made, every time you saw police, even if they weren't even looking at you, even if they weren't interested in you, there was this little boiling hatred that was just bubbling over inside of you.
Tearing off the boys running for the bus, blood. What's going on there? I'll be real with you, yeah? Brixton did have its issues. There was high unemployment, street crime, robberies, and all the papers were full of stories about muggings and black crime. So the police did have a problem on their hands. At the same time, yeah, Caribbean life was banging, right, boy? Thriving on the streets. Brixton was where everyone wanted to be, bruv. Where everyone hung out, played music, caught up, did business. Back in the 70s, most police had never seen anything like it.
I didn't regard myself in any way as a racist, because quite frankly, I'd had very, very little dealings with anybody of colour. There'd been a couple of Asian kids at my school, but that was about it. Suddenly, I was surrounded by a large Afro-Caribbean population whose culture I quite frankly didn't understand and had no experience of.
That's Peter Blexley. You might recognise him. These days, he has a media career presenting shows about crime. But back in the late 1970s, he was a rookie PC with the Met Police. Being posted to inner city London was a huge culture shock.
I had come from a fairly leafy outer London suburb in Bexley Heath. Suddenly, I was policing an inner city area riddled with chronic social deprivation, rampant racism, and a lot of crime. I hadn't really considered what I was going to do in the world of policing. I wasn't particularly ideological. I was politically naive. I just thought catching bad guys sounds like fun. It was as simple as that.
And in some parts of London, the black guys were seen as the bad guys, and it was splashed across the papers. We were a problem and we needed to be solved.
If you were black, if you were young, if you were walking down the streets of South London, then you stood a very good chance of getting stopped and searched. And sometimes that would be a pretty unceremonious experience. When I went on the crime squad, there was what I'd call a squash ladder on the wall. It was a long, thin kind of bracket into which pieces of card would be slotted. And so every arrest was written down on a piece of card, and so the numbers tallied up. And if it got towards the end of the month and the target of 100 arrests had not been achieved, then the detective sergeant would say, come on, we've got to get to the 100 for the month. And some of the members of those crime squad would just go out and fit up the first young black man that they came across, merely to hit the figures, and they were utterly, utterly unscrupulous about it and would boast about it. There was some deeply shameful practices carried out on people.
They would deliberately drive around, see us, jump out, hold us by the neck, dig their hands in our pocket looking for drugs. When you responded to them in a stop and search, in a confrontational way, six or seven police officers were jumping you. That's what happened to me. And then they would get you in the back of the van and all of them would beat you up with their truncheons. That happened to me quite a lot.
Now, not every cop did it, but a significant number did. And this was our policing in South London in the late 70s and the early 80s was often done.
Tensions were rising, and it was happening elsewhere too. Remember Paul, the little white kid? He'd grown up.
I always wanted to be a guitarist because I thought it could be a bit flash.
He'd done the 70s thing, he'd gone to art college, dropped out and joined a band with his mate called Joe Strummer. They were called The Clash. Now, he was in Notting Hill, another place like Brixton, where Caribbean culture and music flow.
I struggled listening to white music like The Who or The Kinks to hear what the bass is doing. So it became natural to me to put the reggae stuff that I loved and play along to that. Because at least I could hear the sound, and it taught me the feel. Well, it taught me how to play, really, so I was fortunate having that backup.
In August 1976, in Notting Hill, it was carnival time.
In the weeks leading up to carnival, you'd have the carnival spirit in making all your costumes, and the steel bands, they would be practicing, and you would be making your costume.
Meet Leela Hassan Howe. She just knows carnival is an event like no other.
So it was a movement, it was a carnival movement that involved thousands of people up and down the country, ordinary people being creative and making and designing their costumes and going out on the day to play carnival. And the day itself, you were free to go on the streets. You could just go on the streets and dance.
It was like a splash of colour, sound systems playing, great music. Police and Thieves was the hit of that carnival, and you would hear that all the time, and it was like the soundtrack to the whole atmosphere. You could pick up chicken, rice and peas on the street for next to nothing. There's stalls, there's crowds, it's all like, yeah, it's pretty buoyant.
And it was just a wonderful feeling of freedom. I always tell people that until you play carnival on the road in Notting Hill, you will never get that sense of freedom just for that one day when you just really feel you're free and the streets belong to you.
But that year, the police were worried because carnival was growing. 1975 had seen the biggest turnout since carnival began, a decade earlier. The police said it was attracting pickpockets and thieves. They tried to move it off the streets to like Battersea Park or White City Stadium. Organisers said no chance, it was not happening. Instead, the police turned up with an almighty show of force. More than 3,000 officers were drafted in, 10 times the number on duty than in previous years. Leela says it set everyone on edge from the off.
Everybody on that day, all everybody kept saying was, why are there so many police here? Why do you need so many police to police people who've come to dance and listen to music? And so it's just thousands of police. You feel it in the air. You feel the tension. People saying, what's going on? What's going on? Why are there so many police? You know, what are they doing?
We were there at that crucial point when it kicked off, because the police went in quite heavy-handed to try and arrest somebody they suspected as being a pickpocket. So they barged through the crowd, and of course the crowd resented their presence in the first place, and so started lobbing paper cups, which turned into cans, and because of the bomb sites, the rubble, that suddenly it was bricks. Suddenly the cops backed off, vanished, and then within moments came back in force and charged the crowd.
According to the police, the trouble began when a small group of youths threw stones and beer cans at policemen. Throughout 2 days of carnival, the police had been in the area in strength, complaining that pickpocketing in the tightly packed crowds had been rife and that attempts to arrest the culprits were impeded, sometimes by onlookers. Carnival organisers complained tonight that there had been far too many policemen on duty in the area and that their presence had caused nervousness and tension. The battle went on in several streets off Ladbroke Grove, policemen grabbing dustbin lids, trays, even fruit boxes to protect themselves.
It was total anarchy. There's people shouting, there's stuff being lobbed at the cops, there's glass, bricks everywhere.
The community was saying, you're not passing here, you know, we don't want you here, you need to go. But the fight that happened, what you saw was just the youth using whatever was at their disposal to punch, fight, push, and have a fight with the police, just throwing things at the police, hurling missiles at them to get them away and to get them off the streets.
Paul is the sort of Brixton guy that isn't just going to walk away. He's going to get stuck in.
The feeling of exhilaration that you could just pick up a brick and lob it at the cops, and it was pure joy for me. And I don't know, for good or bad, that's how I reacted. Yeah, at one point, me and Joe, we thought, well, look, there's a car upside down, let's try and set it alight. So we had some matches and we're trying to set it alight, and it's like, it was impossible. We could not. A pair of useless rioters. We couldn't even set the car alight. So we gave up in the end. But then I have seen footage, and the car is alight. But I think maybe somebody more professional came over and took over. I mean, I got to say, it didn't surprise me that it kicked off like it had, because, you know, resentment had been growing for a long time. It had just been bottled up. And here was a moment of release for any anger that you had, or resentment, or feelings of injustice. Was here was the time to let it loose, and people did.
More than 100 officers and 60 members of the public ended up in hospital. Until this moment, it was only the police that dished it out. They were the all-powerful. After years of oppression with the police, London's black kids had seen if they get together to fight back, they might just win. For the first time, the tables had turned. And the youth certainly wouldn't forget this moment. It would prove to be a warm-up for what would happen in Brixton 5 years later.
The police lost and the youth won. So you're feeling good because the police got hiding. I mean, I'm sorry to put it so brutally, but that's how we feel.
Now, people were fighting back and they weren't going to take it anymore. Policeman Peter Blexley says he saw it coming.
The unscrupulous and unlawful practices of the police, in terms of fitting people up, beating people up, stopping and searching people without any justification whatsoever, led to the riots in Brixton of 1981. Without a shadow of a doubt. You cannot repress and suppress a sizable population for year on year, keep your foot on its throat, keep kicking it and kicking it and kicking it without expecting there to be some kind of backlash.
So now you've got a taste of Brixton in the 1970s. Well, every action has a reaction. Our Brixton kids, Sheldon, Christopher and Tony, growing up, saw all of this. They took it in. They took it on. Until they were prepared to destroy the very place they loved. The fuse was lit.
When people ask me, oh, but you was a thug, you did this, you burnt Brixton down, people don't understand. I became that because society made me. How would you respond for years of abuse? Physically, mentally. That's how I became this thug, this nasty, hateful, mentally disturbed guy that would wake up every day saying, what white man am I going to kill today? What police officer am I going to maim today?
That's episode one of Brixton, Flames on the Frontline. We're going to hear more from these guys later in the series, including how and why Sheldon became so consumed by rage. Tell me what you're thinking right now. That something's badly wrong? Well, you don't know the half of it. Things are about to get much worse. In episode 2, the stakes are raised. We'll meet a new group of characters and their lives are about to be turned upside down.
You know, you knew you were being stopped and searched because you were black. Once you were arrested or even taken in for questioning, your heads would be flushed down toilets.
The moment we were arrested, the world changed. The world changed completely. Everything was crashed around me there and then.
This is Nas. I'm here to tell you about a new podcast about the greatest there ever was.
Muhammad Ali versus Joe Frazier was more than a prize fight.
A fight that stopped the world in its tracks.
It's an onslaught now.
A fight that changed the world forever.
15 hours ago, I left the ringside of Madison Square Garden, New York, carrying with me the videotape recording of one of the most extraordinary fights of all time.
A boxing match that transcended the sport.
Muhammad Ali became a martyr in many ways. He forsaked everything to refuse to go and fight.
The fight of the century, Ali versus Frazier. Listen on the BBC Sounds app.